Chapter 7. How to Ignite a Hotbed. Education is not the filling of a pail, but the lighting of a fire. W.B. Yeats. Mike and Dave's ridiculous idea. Talent hotbeds like Curacao, Russia and South Korea were ignited by a lightning strike, a breakthrough star, a magical victory. No one could have predicted or planned them. A different kind of ignition occurs when there's no lightning strike, and yet motivation and talent bloom anyway. This is the kind of ignition that relates more directly to our daily lives, and I found it happening most vividly in an unexpected place, a group of inner-city schools. In the winter of 1993, Mike Feinberg and Dave Levin were not doing well. They were in their early 20s. Roommates and second-year teachers in the Houston public school system. Both were members of Teach for America, a fledgling non-profit group through which recent college graduates taught for 2 years in low-income schools. Feinberg and Levin's first year had been rocky. Slashed tires, chaotic classes. Their second year, slightly worse. They tried to innovate but had found their efforts blocked by incompetent bureaucracy, unhelpful parents, misbehaving students, hide-bound regulations, and the other blunt cogs of the most efficient frustration machine ever invented, the American inner-city public school system. Levin had been asked not to return to his school. Feinberg, reaching an even deeper depth, found himself wishfully contemplating law school. So they spent their winter evenings sitting around their crummy Houston apartment, engaging in the time-honored activity of 20-somethings everywhere, bitching about work, drinking beer, and watching Star Trek. Their mindset was later summed up by Feinberg, "Life sucks, and then you die." One night during that long winter, for reasons that remain mysterious, an inspiring speech they'd attended, they think, or maybe it was the beer, these two failed Gen Xers suddenly had a perverse idea. They would stop fighting the system and start their own school. They put on a pot of coffee, set the stereo to play Achtung Baby by U2 on repeat, and by 5 a.m. they had printed a manifesto containing the four pillars of their creation: more classroom time, quality teachers, parental support, and administrative support. The caffeine must have kicked in, because the two baptized their project with a name that was as grandiose as anything Captain Kirk could dream up. They called it the Knowledge is Power Program, or K-I-P-P, KIP. At any other moment in history, an idea as vague as KIP, supported by little but inexperience, would have evaporated. But as it happened, Texas had recently passed laws funding charter schools, provided they achieved baseline educational standards. This resulted, a few months later, in a situation that would have previously been unthinkable. These two newbies and their coffee-stained manifesto would get their shot. Not a whole school. The Board of Education wasn't that crazy, but a single room in the corner of Garcia Elementary, where Feinberg and Levin would be free to take the next inevitable step on their idealistic journey. Fall on their faces. The majority of charter schools are built on a foundation of educational theory, such as Waldorf, Montessori, or Piaget. Feinberg and Levin, short on time, instead followed the principles of Butch Cassidy. They stole. They located their district's best teachers and nabbed lesson plans, teaching techniques, management ideas, schedules, rules, everything. Feinberg and Levin would later be called innovative, but at the time they were about as innovative as a shoplifter during a blackout. "We took every good idea that wasn't nailed down," Feinberg said. "We took everything but the kitchen sink. And then we went back and took the kitchen sink, too." From this pile of stolen parts, they assembled an educational jalopy. It featured an engine of old-fashioned hard work, longer school days, shorter summer vacations, uniforms, a clear system of punishment and reward, encased in a skin of innovative techniques. Times tables would be learned via rapping. Kids would be given teachers' home phone numbers for homework questions. On the wall, Feinberg and Levin pasted a slogan pilfered from a renowned Los Angeles teacher named Rafe Esquith, "Work hard, be nice," and pointed their jalopy toward a distant goal, to do whatever it took to get the students into college. "It was clear to us from the start that college is really the key to the whole thing," Feinberg said. "When you get out there in the public school system of big cities, you realize how screwed up it is, how the zip code you're born in basically determines your chance of failing or succeeding. College is the door out." That spring and summer, Feinberg and Levin set about recruiting subjects for their experiment. After an intensive neighborhood campaign, they wound up with 50 students, most of whose parents were just as frustrated with the status quo as Feinberg and Levin were. When Kipps, first class, walked into the tiny room for their first day, college seemed a long way off. The students ranked well below average in ability. Only 53% had passed the state English and math tests the previous year. The room was overcrowded. Their host school put up a steady resistance to their presence. The longer school days, 7:30 a.m. to 5 p.m., plus classes every other Saturday, per the manifesto, put a strain on everyone. But then something strange happened. It was impossible to put a finger on it, but at some point that autumn, the jalopy coughed, sputtered, and started moving. To the amazement of everyone, not least Feinberg and Levin, the KIPP students lived up to their slogan. They were nice, and they worked hard. Extremely hard. At the end of the first year, 90% of the students passed the state exams. Encouraged, Feinberg and Levin kept going. For the first years, they taught like nomads. Feinberg stayed in Houston while Levin relocated to the Bronx. They fought for space, taught in trailers, and cadged unused rooms. Each year they stole more good ideas and tossed out the ones that failed, and each year KIPP's test scores kept rising. By 1999, the KIPP academies in Houston and the Bronx were scoring higher on standardized tests than any other public schools in their respective districts. The jalopy wasn't just picking up speed. It was lapping the field. Word spread. After a 60 Minutes report, KIPP received a $15 million donation from Donald and Doris Fisher, founders of the Gap clothing store. Dozens, then hundreds of young teachers, many of them from the Teach for America program, which has subsequently become highly successful, placing 2,900 new teachers each year and attracting applications from 10% of Georgetown's, Yale's and Harvard's 2008 graduating classes, signed on to start their own KIPP schools. By 2008, there were 66 KIPP schools from Los Angeles to New York, serving 16,000 students. Many KIPP schools now produce students who achieve some of the highest scores in their respective cities, and, most crucially, 80% of KIPP students go on to attend college. Feinberg and Levin still teach fifth graders in Houston and the Bronx, in addition to overseeing the KIPP schools in their areas and working on KIPP's National Board of Directors. Jason Snipes, a member of Harvard University's Council of Great City Schools, sums up their success in Andrew Jones's terms. "KIPP is really knocking it out of the park." One way to look at KIPP is as a unique tale of good-hearted underdogs who caught lightning in a bottle. If that were all it was, our interest in the story would end now. The other way to look at it, however, is as an example of pure ignition, the art and science of creating a talent hotbed from the ground up without the assistance of a World Series homer or any other magical breakthrough. That's why it's useful to look under the hood of this remarkable jalopy to see what makes it go. Curtain up. At most schools, the first day of a new academic year is likened to the first few strides of a marathon run, or perhaps the first skirmish of an insurgent war. At KIPP schools like KIPP Heartwood Academy in San Jose, California, however, the first day is like opening night for a Broadway play. There are scripts, timed entrances and plot lines, a nervous audience, and, 10 minutes before curtain, a backstage pre-show huddle. At KIPP Hartwood, that teacher's huddle takes place in an empty classroom a few steps from the outdoor courtyard where the students are beginning to assemble. OK, people, let's be quick and sharp out there, says Saber Ali, the school leader, to her staff of 15 teachers. We'll clap them in, do the welcome, the college talk, introduce each teacher, then do the be nice talk at the end. Everybody got it? Saber Ali is 31 years old and 5 feet tall. She is wearing a sleek beige pantsuit and softly clicking high heels, and she carries herself with a silken but unmistakable authority, a hybrid of Audrey Hepburn and Erwin Rommel. Ali has no earthly need to repeat this information. It's all neatly typed on the script for the day, which accounts for every event, transition and activity. For the past few days, the staff has been reviewing the script in detail. They spent, for instance, a full hour discussing the correct body spacing and foot placement for KIPP fifth graders standing in a straight line. By now, this day has been rehearsed and practiced to a nit, as Ali puts it. In the courtyard, milling in the early morning sunshine, stand the 140 new KIPP students and their families. The kids are jumpy. The parents smother their own nervousness with reassuring smiles and hugs. They are mostly Hispanic, with a handful of Asians and African Americans. They come from San Jose's boundless sea of low-rent bungalows and government-subsidized apartments. Like many KIPP schools, this one began small, with Ali's door-to-door neighborhood campaign in 2004, as she asked parents about their experiences in the public school and inquired if they might be interested in an alternative. Around the neighborhood, Ali was known as the lady who asks a lot of questions. The first year, KIPP had 75 fifth graders. Since then, they've added 275 more students and 3 additional grade levels, and now they have a fast-growing waiting list. All of which helps account for the atmosphere of poignant excitement here in the courtyard. The air is filled with a sense of irrevocable departure, as if the kids are boarding an ocean liner bound for a new world. While the vast majority of KIPP Hartwood students come from the local school district, not all of them do. Letha Narayanan had driven her son an hour from their home in Fremont, California. Narayanan, who had a well-paying job with an internet consulting firm, said the public schools in her neighborhood were high quality. She had come to KIPP, however, because she wanted to make 100% sure that her son, Ajit, would go on to attend college. I heard about what they do here, she said. I said, I want this for my child. At precisely 8 a.m., Ali and the rest of the teachers walk to the courtyard. Ali claps 5 times. The other teachers join in, counting them out. The kids fall silent. The parents instinctively fall away. Good morning, Ali says loudly. The kids murmur. Good morning, Ali repeats. Good morning, a few say. Ali tilts her head, disappointed, expectant. Good morning, she tries again. Another teacher, Lolita Jackson, offers the right response. Good morning, Ms. Ali. This time, they get it. The next time Ali prompts them, the response comes in a chorus. Good morning, Ms. Ali. Ali welcomes them, referring to each class by its new name. The fifth graders are the class of 2015. The sixth are 2014. The number refers to the year in which they'll enter college. Ali then calls upon a group of returning students, distinctive in their white and green KIPP shirts, to model a line. They place their sneakers precisely along one of the coloured stripes painted on the courtyard, eyes forward, hands down, neatly spaced. This is what a line at KIPP looks like, Ali says, as an assistant translates in Spanish. Does everyone understand? Yes, Ms. Ali, they say as one, catching on. Each child is introduced by name, handed a large 3-ring binder, and given a group clap of praise on the beat. Backpacks, water bottles and coats are left with parents, they need nothing. KIPP teachers walk up and down the growing lines, making sure binders are held in the left hand, nice and flat, with spine down, that feet are straight, hands are extended, shirts tucked in. Urged to smile, none do. Ali walks the line. She stops at one boy and makes a 20-degree correction in the angle at which he is holding his binder. This is KIPP culture. It covers how to walk, how to talk. They work on the 3-inch voice, the 12-inch voice, and the room voice. How to sit at a desk, forward, upright, no pencil in hand. How to look at a teacher or classmate who's speaking, called tracking. Head up, eyes on them, shoulders toward the speaker. And even how to negotiate the bathroom. Use 4 or 5 sheets of toilet paper, 1 squirt of soap to wash hands. KIPP teachers plant trash around the school and see who picks it up, then celebrate that person in front of the group. They are constantly executing precise routines of clapping, chanting, and walking together. Older students operate under more relaxed rules. They needn't walk in lines, for instance, but even those privileges are earned. Every single detail matters, Feinberg says. Everything they do is connected to everything else around them. After forming lines, the new students are brought into a classroom where they sit on the floor along taped lines. There are no desks because, the students are informed, they haven't earned them yet. The students open their binders to find several pages of math problems. This is silent work time, a morning staple at KIPP. After half an hour of cathedral-like silence, the first few whispers and giggles are hushed by teachers. After that, the quiet takes hold. Mazzali strides to the front of the room and welcomes them again by their class names. Our goal, everyone tracking me now, as a team and family, is that every single person in this room is going to college. Ali stops and lets the idea sink in. She repeats the phrase, going to college, with slow and reverent relish, the same way a priest might say, going to heaven. Where are we going? She asks. College, comes the tentative reply. Hand cupped to her ear, Ali feigns deafness. College! They shout louder. Ali smiles, a flash of happiness, then gets serious. I'm going to be straight with you. There are a lot of people who think you can't do it because your family doesn't have money, because you're Latino or Vietnamese. But here at KIPP, we believe in you. If you work hard and are nice, you will go to college and have a successful life. You will be extraordinary because here we work really, really hard. And that makes you smart. You will make mistakes. You will mess up. We will too. But you will all have beautiful behavior because everything here at KIPP is earned. Everything is earned. Everything is earned. You're on the floor. Are you uncomfortable? Do you wish you had desks? You will have to earn them. When you can track, when you clap together, when you can act like KIPP students, then you can have those desks. Ali's dark brown eyes search the room, seeking connections. The students gaze back, nervous, excited, fully awake. To an outsider like me, the level of discipline seems over the top, which is why neighborhood smart alecks call it the Kids in Prison program. But the results are clear. These kids are responding, engaging. We are watching you, Ali continues. Everything here is a test. Everything here is earned. Is that clear? They nod. When I say clear, you say crystal, Ali says. She looks around the room, her eyes glittering expectantly. She tries again. Is that clear? 140 voices say, crystal! If we had to classify the primal cues the KIPP students received in those first few minutes, they would fall into 3 categories. 1. You belong to a group. 2. Your group is together in a strange and dangerous new world. 3. That new world is shaped like a mountain, with the paradise of college at the top. These three signals might seem unique, but in fact they're identical to the primal cues that any young Brazilian soccer player or Russian tennis player might receive if you replaced the word college with the words being Ronaldinho, Kournikova. Bereft of such naturally occurring aspirational figures, Kip does the next best thing. It creates its own São Paulo, a signal-rich world so seamless that it creates new patterns of motivation and behavior, hence Kip's Spielbergian insistence on timing, continuity, and plot. Like Frank Curiel Field in Curaçao, Kip's physical environs radiate signals. Like a squadron of Tom Sawyers, Kip's teachers fire cues rapidly and clearly. As Feinberg likes to say, everything is everything. This sounds like New Age palaver, but what he's really talking about is Kip's insistence on environmental coherency. The way every element of this world, from the painted stripes on the floor to the eyes of the teacher, to the angle with which students carry their binders, sends clear, constant signals of belonging and identity. You are at Kip. You are a Kipster. Instead of ready, set, go, they say ready, set, Kip. Students address each other as teammates. Kip teachers refer to this process only half-jokingly as Kipnosis. I remember when I came to visit, said Michael Mann, who teaches social studies. I thought it was way extreme. I thought it was ridiculous. I mean, who cares how they hold their binder? But I came to see that attention to detail is a big part of what makes someone academically successful. The rules are ways of getting them to practice being detailed and precise, and that's not something a lot of them have had any experience with. Kip teachers are not alone in their belief in this tactic. In 2005, psychologists Martin Seligman and Angela Duckworth studied several parameters of 164 eighth graders, including IQ, along with 5 tests that measured self-discipline. It turned out that self-discipline was twice as accurate as IQ in predicting the student's grade point average. For every year of their lives up to now, the students have been acting in certain ways, Feinberg said. The culture is an incredibly strong force, and the only way to reach them is to change the way they see themselves. It seems intense to somebody visiting, but that's what it takes. One of the ways Kip creates that change is through a technique it calls stopping the school. This is not fanciful language. When someone violates a significant rule, classes screech to a halt, and teachers and students hold a meeting to discuss what just happened and how to fix it. A few weeks before I visited, the school had stopped because a sixth grader had teased another student, calling her an elephant. The previous stop had happened when a student rolled his eyes at a teacher. By most reasoning, stopping the school when a student teases or rolls their eyes is a gigantic waste of time. And yet it works. Kip, like a giant link trainer, creates an environment for deep practice in good behaviour. Stopping the school for an eye roll is not inefficient. On the contrary, Kip has found that it's the most efficient way to establish group priorities, locate errors, and build the behavioural circuits that Kip desires. Not surprisingly, from a deep practice point of view at least, Toyota employs the same technique on its assembly lines, with great success. As you can tell, Kip's most important signal, its version of an Andrew Jones home run, is college, or, as it's invariably voiced at Kip, college! College is the spiritus sancti that is involved hundreds of times each day, not so much as a place as a glowing ideal. Each homeroom is named after the college the teacher attended. Math classes are in Berkeley, social studies in USC, special education at Cornell Graduate School. Kip teachers are skilled at slipping references to college into conversation, always with the presumption that all the students are destined for those golden shores. While I visited a social studies class, one student turned in her homework without her name on it. Her teacher's response was to stop the class. "You know how many papers your college professor is going to get?" the teacher asked, radiating incredulity. You think he's going to take the time to figure out it's yours? Think about that. As English teacher Leslie Eichler said, we say college as often as people in other schools say Even the lettering above the classroom mirrors inquires, where will you go to college? KIPP students start visiting colleges as soon as they're enrolled. KIPP Hartwood's fifth graders go to California schools like USC, Stanford and UCLA, while seventh graders fly to the East Coast to walk the campuses of Yale, Columbia and Brown, among others. While there, they meet with KIPP alumni who tell of their own journeys. Right now, college is just a vague idea to them, Ali tells me later, gesturing at the new fifth graders. But by the end of the fifth grade, after they make a visit, we overhear them talking about it among themselves, saying things like, yeah, I like Berkeley, but I think I'm more of a Cal Poly person. That's when we know it's clicking. When they get to KIPP, their lives are like a single dot on a map. You can't do anything with a dot, Feinberg said. But when they connect that dot to another dot, to a college somewhere, then you get a connection. When they get back from those trips, they carry themselves differently. This simple, powerful idea is made real in Lolita Jackson's math class. Jackson, who's in her late 50s, is a small woman who wears gigantic earrings and radiates galvanic discipline and enthusiasm. She spent the first 20 years of her career working in the local public school system, increasingly frustrated by its limitations. When KIPP Hartwood came along, however, she joined up and quickly rose to become one of its most effective teachers, as well as its assistant principal. Ali regards Jackson's skills as near magical. Ms. Jackson does things that nobody else can do, Ali says simply. For instance, each year after orientation week is finished, Jackson begins her first math class by clicking off the lights and asking students to close their eyes. She slips a Star Wars soundtrack into the CD player and turns it up. As the triumphal music surges, Jackson strides around the room as if she were the captain of a rocket ship on countdown. You buckled up, Kippsters? She asks. You ready? You strapped in good and tight? Because this is going to be a bumpy ride. It's going to be tough and it's going to be hard, but it's also going to be great because we are going to work and learn some math and we are going to college. The kids sit quietly, the music resounding in their heads. College, Jackson repeats, tasting the word. Do you want to know the difference between a good life and a hard life? Do you want to know the difference between having the knowledge and power to get the things you want and not having that knowledge? Fasten your seatbelts because that's where you are going, starting right now. Like Spartak, Meadowmount and the other talent hotbeds, KIPP Hartwood is a bastion of deep practice. Jackson and her colleagues constantly remind KIPP students that their brains are muscles. The more they work them, the smarter they will get, and there's plenty of work to do. 2 hours of homework a night is standard. Worksheets number in the hundreds. The day is filled with stretches of intense, silent work. As Feinberg said, softer methods might work in other schools, but we literally don't have any hours to waste, much less days or weeks. Our kids arrive way behind. We need to get them up to speed and ahead. It's like the fourth quarter of a football game. We're down by a touchdown, and we've got to get downfield and score now. The touchdowns are happening. In 2007, KIPP Hartwood students ranked in the top 3% of California public schools, according to the state's Standardized Testing and Reporting Program. What's striking in the end, however, is not how hard KIPP students work, but rather how swiftly and completely they take on the KIPP identity that provides the fuel for that hard work. On both of my visits, I was approached by students who wanted to know how I was doing, if there was anything they might do for me, and of course, where I went to college. Some of these exchanges felt a bit scripted. The overly firm handshakes, the fervently agreeable nodding, the geisha-level politeness. But beneath the artifice vibrated the sincere effort of someone stretching toward a new persona. I like it here a lot, said Daniel Magana, a crew-cut sixth grader. There's no special treatment for anybody. At my old school, they let me slide. I could do 5 out of 10 things and nobody cared. Here, I do 10 out of 10. Daniel, whose father is a construction worker, plans to be the first member of his family to attend college. He's not so sure which college yet. He's going to consider the California system. It's so much cheaper, you know. And he needs a pretty big school, one that offers a double major in his desired fields of laser surgery and creative writing. So he's thinking Berkeley. But that could change, he said sagely. We'll see. When I asked Daniel to tell me what he was like back before he enrolled in KIPP, he looked gravely to the tile floor as if peering into an ancient archaeological dig. Different, he said finally. I think I didn't really like school. It was boring. At my old school, I used 25% of my brain, but here I use 100%. Ancient history didn't hold his interest long, however, and soon Daniel raced off on new tangents, inquiring about the ages of my kids and recommending books for them, asking about my travels, and then checking the clock and saying, "Sorry, nice talking with you, but he'd better get to English class. Handshake. Goodbye." And I'm left standing with a question. Who exactly is this kid? How much of Daniel is Daniel, and how much is a result of his experience at KIPP? There's no way to say whether Daniel Magana would have been an ambitious, considerate, high-achieving kid had he not attended KIPP. Perhaps he would have been the same, or perhaps once he graduates from KIPP he'll revert to old patterns. But as I watch him disappear into the crowd, I'm struck by how KIPP alters our instinctive notion of character. Usually we think of character as deep and unchanging, an innate quality that flows outward, showing itself through behaviour. KIPP shows that character might be more like a skill, ignited by certain signals and honed through deep practice. Seen this way, KIPP stands on a foundation of myelin. Every time a KIPP student imagines himself in college, a surge of energy is created, not unlike that created in South Korea when girls imagine themselves to be Seri Park. Every time a KIPP student forces himself to obey one of these persnickety rules, a circuit is fired, insulated, and strengthened. Impulse control, after all, is a circuit like any other. Every time the entire school screeches to a halt to fix misbehavior, skills are being built as surely as they were when Clarissa did her start-stop attack on Golden Wedding. No wonder Daniel Magana is such a polite, well-disciplined young man. He has been ignited to deep practice those qualities. What we do here is like lighting a switch, Ali said. It's extremely deliberate. It's not random. There's no chance involved. You have to stand behind what you do to make sure every single detail is pushing the same way. Then it clicks. The kids get it. And when it starts, the rest of them get it too. It's contagious.